From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the FBI files on Frank Sinatra. We talk with journalists Tom and Phil Koons, editors of a new book that excerpts and analyzes the 1,275-page dossier on the singer. Most of the files were compiled under the eye of J. Edgar Hoover, whose agents tried to find out if Sinatra was a draft dodger, a communist, or connected to the mob. Also, we meet an American who has become China's first independent film producer, Peter Lohr. We'll find out what it's like to produce and distribute independent films in a communist country practicing censorship. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Scientists announced today that the human genetic code has essentially been deciphered. The achievement is the result of 10 years of work by public and private researchers. Two teams of scientists announced that they've mapped 90% of the human genome. Researchers say the next step is to identify disease-causing genes and treat disease at the molecular level. Ethicists warn that the ability to read genetic codes presents a privacy issue because employers or insurance companies could potentially use such information to reject people whose genetic makeup predisposes them to disease. For the first time since early May, the national average price for gasoline has stopped rising. It's especially good news for drivers in the Midwest, where the price increases had been the steepest. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
After seven straight weeks of price increases that totaled 26 cents a gallon, the price of gasoline has finally dropped. The Federal Energy Department says over the past week, the average price for a gallon of regular has decreased by 2 cents. Most motorists, though, won't notice a price drop. If anything, they're seeing price increases of a penny or two. But energy officials say the price has dropped so much here in the Midwest, 7 cents a gallon, it's more than neutralized the price hikes in all the other regions. So the overall average price is down. The lower price comes on the heels of a decision by OPEC nations to pump more oil and federal investigations and hearings into the price hikes. President Clinton says the high prices mean the U.S. must develop fuel-efficient cars and alternative energy sources. For NPR News, I'm Bill Cohen in Columbus.
The Irish Republican Army has allowed international inspectors to look at its secret weapons caches in Northern Ireland. The Deputy First Minister called on pro-British paramilitary groups to reciprocate. Marianne McGuire reports from Belfast.
The report of the International Weapons Inspectors is a milestone for the peace process. The inspectors say they are satisfied the IRA is cooperating fully. They state that a substantial amount of weapons and explosives has been secured and can no longer be used without their knowledge. The Irish Sinn Féin leader was the first to welcome the move. Gerry Adams says the inspections prove that the IRA is committed to peace.
It didn't have to do this. It didn't have to make those commitments. It did so, I think, because it wanted to assure those people who need assurance that Republicans are serious.
But pro-British unionists have already warned that the developments are only a first step towards full disarmament. For NPR News, I'm Marianne McGuire in Belfast.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 138 points, or 1.3%, to close at 10,543 in light trading. Volume was 884 million shares. The Nasdaq gained 49 points to close at 3,894. This is NPR News. The Supreme Court must now decide whether to consider the case of Elian Gonzalez. The boy's Miami relatives have filed a formal appeal with the Supreme Court seeking to prevent the boy's father from taking him back to Cuba. Last week, a federal appeals court in Atlanta rejected the relatives' request for a rehearing. The relatives have also asked the Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy to keep Elian in the country until the court acts on the request. If the court doesn't act, Elian and his father could leave the U.S. as early as Wednesday. The Supreme Court ruled today that California's blanket primary system is unconstitutional. The blanket primary allows voters to cross party lines in nominating candidates. More from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
California voters adopted the blanket primary by ballot initiative in 1996. It allows all registered voters to choose any candidate for any office regardless of party. For instance, a voter could choose a Republican Senate candidate and a Democratic candidate for governor. The state's Republican and Democratic parties sued, as did the Libertarians and the Peace and Freedom Party. They argued that the blanket primary violated their rights to freely associate with those of similar beliefs, and the Supreme Court agreed on a 7-2 vote. Writing for the majority, Justice Antonin Scalia said the blanket primary was forcing political parties to associate with those who do not share their beliefs at the crucial juncture at which party members traditionally select their spokesman. Ina Jaffe, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The Supreme Court ruled today that police still have to read suspects their rights when questioning them. The so-called Miranda rights include telling suspects they have a right to remain silent. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Frank Sinatra was one of the most written about celebrities of his era, but it wasn't just journalists who were chronicling his life. It was the FBI. The Bureau amassed a 1,275-page dossier on the singer and actor. That dossier is excerpted and analyzed in the new book, The Sinatra Files. My guests are the editors Tom Koons, he's an editor with the New York Times, and his brother Phil Koons, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. During the Rat Pack era, the FBI investigated Sinatra's connections to the mob. During the red baiting era, the FBI wanted to know if Sinatra was a communist or fellow traveler. Part of what sparked the FBI's interest was the 1945 short film, The House I Live in which Sinatra sang a song that carried a message against racism. The film was scripted by Albert Maltz, who was later blacklisted as one of the Hollywood Ten. The song was written by Earl Robinson and Lewis Allen.
What is America to me? A name, a map, or a flag I see? A certain word, democracy. What is America? I live in a plot of earth, a street, the grocer and the butcher, and the people that I meet, the children in the playground.
Tom and Phil Koons described the FBI files on Sinatra as a shadow biography of the singer. I asked Tom Koons about the FBI's investigation into Sinatra's ties to mobsters.
One thing that the FBI files prove beyond any doubt is that Frank Sinatra hung out with mobsters. There's little doubt about that. They have firsthand accounts of, you know, of witnesses describing Sinatra hanging out with these people. They have, for a time, they were actually observing Sinatra hanging out with Sam Giancana. There are tape recordings of mobsters talking about their having had conversations with Sinatra. All of this proves beyond any doubt that he was hanging out with mobsters. What the FBI was suspicious of, and one could say somewhat legitimately, is that Sinatra was a popular singer of the time, and he was also entertaining and getting involved in business deals in Las Vegas and elsewhere. The FBI was concerned that the mob was going to infiltrate those business enterprises, and they were always on the lookout for people who were acting as fronts for the mob. Sinatra, being a close friend of some of these mobsters, was an obvious suspect. They never got anything, you know, definitive in that regard. Later, Sinatra was also befriended some prominent politicians, and that I don't think anybody can dispute that that made him worthy of attention if he was hanging out with mobsters and presidents and other prominent politicians at the same time.
One of the stories in The Legend of Frank Sinatra is that he got his part in From Here to Eternity, the part that revived his career, because the mob kind of went to bat for him in Hollywood. And that's a story that's retold in The Godfather in a slightly different form. Any truth behind that you were able to find in the FBI files?
There's scant evidence of that in the FBI files. I think we have to regard that as a myth, a canard. Another myth in the Sinatra legend is that early in his career, he used mob muscle to get out of his contract with Tommy Dorsey, which entitled Tommy Dorsey to 43% of the singer's earnings for life. The files have no evidence that that the mob had anything to do with Tommy Dorsey releasing him from that contract. So the files are interesting for what they don't prove, as well as for what they reveal about Sinatra and the FBI.
A famous Rat Pack evening has been issued on CD or reissued on CD, and it was the grand reopening of the club Villa Venice in suburban Chicago, a club either owned or financed by Sam Giancana, the head of the Chicago mob. And an informant tells the FBI, and this is in your book, that the Villa Venice is financially in trouble, and for this reason, Sinatra and his associates are scheduled to entertain. They are not going to receive the amount of money they reportedly were scheduled to receive in return for their services. The implication being that they're doing that this is a benefit for their buddy Sam Giancana. In fact, Dean Martin kids about this in a medley of songs that he does. Why don't we hear his satirical lyric to "The Lady Is a Tramp"?
I love Chicago. It's carefree and gay. I'd even work here without any pay. I'll lay you off. It turns out that way. That's why this gentleman is a tramp. My clever agent, he worked out this deal. He said, go to Chicago, it won't be for real. And I believed him. I'm such a schlemiel. That's why the gentleman is a tramp.
That's Dean Martin from an evening of the Rat Pack at the club Villa Venice, which was financed by Sam Giancana. What was the nature of Sinatra's relationship with Giancana?
They were, in looking over the files, I struggled with that, and I think I've come to the conclusion that they both were kind of, on some level, sycophantic. The mobster liked to hang out with Sinatra because he was famous, and Sinatra liked to hang out with mobsters because he was a bad boy. Now, Giancana had a vested interest in courting Sinatra in the 1959-1960 era, because he wanted to somehow gain influence to get the FBI to back off its crackdown on the mob. At this point, the FBI was really getting serious. Hoover, for years, had denied the existence of the mob. He had recently been proved wrong that there was organized crime in the United States, and as a result, started a huge crackdown on them. Sinatra offered a way for them to get friendly with, or at least have entree to, President Kennedy when he started running for president. And there's people quoted in the documents saying that Sinatra was working for the campaign for Jack Kennedy in order to get the mob to have an entree.
Now, Sinatra was also close to John F. Kennedy during the period that Kennedy was running for the presidency. What are the connections that are documented that Sinatra made between the mob and Kennedy?
Well, from early on, Sinatra was introduced to Kennedy by Peter Lawford, who was a Kennedy in-law. And from early on, the FBI knew about Kennedy's relationship with Sinatra, because Kennedy at this point was clearly a presidential aspirant. This is in the late 1950s. So you have the FBI kind of watching almost in real time as their relationship unfolds. And what a relationship it was. I mean, they had a mutual... Sinatra-like power, whether it was legitimate or illegitimate. And Kennedy and Sinatra both like sex, if you believe the FBI files. And the files chronicle their wild partying. One memo refers to, quotes a gangster as saying something about all those broads Sinatra brought JFK. Showgirls running in and out of the senator's suite in Las Vegas, where he and Sinatra were partying. So early on, and through the Kennedy administration, the FBI was was watching Sinatra very closely.
One of the evidence of that is that Sinatra who introduced a former girlfriend of his, Judith Campbell, to President Kennedy, who we now know became his mistress when he was in the White House. And he introduced her to him in January of 1960. Kennedy came to Las Vegas, I think to do some fundraising, but ended up hanging out with Sinatra and the rest of the Rat Pack. They were there filming Ocean's 11, their first big movie. And they were also doing shows at the Sands. Frank Sinatra introduced Judith Campbell to John Kennedy during that visit. And 3 weeks later, a memo appears on Hoover's desk saying that part of it said that Kennedy had been compromised with a woman there. It didn't name who she was, but it's pretty clear that that's who they're referring to. So we didn't find out, meaning the American public didn't find out about Judith Campbell until 1975 or so. J. Edgar Hoover at least had a good hint of what was going on 3 weeks after it happened.
Did Sinatra also introduce Judith Campbell to Sam Giancana? His mistress as well.
She became his mistress at some point. It's not quite clear that there was overlap there. There's some dispute about that. And that is actually how the FBI came to find out for sure about Judith Campbell, because Judith Campbell was associating with Sam Giancana, so the FBI started watching her. Then they noticed that she was making, by looking at her phone records, noticed that not only was she talking to Sam Giancana, one of his underlings named Johnny Roselli, and Frank Sinatra, at the same time that she was on a fairly regular basis calling the White House, President Kennedy's secretary. As a result of those phone calls, J. Edgar Hoover wrote a memo to the Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, the president's brother, informing him, hey, I just wanted to let you know that this woman who's, apparently calling your brother is also hanging out with mobsters. That letter started a chain of events that caused Robert Kennedy to finally confront his brother about basically his relationship with both Sinatra and Judith Campbell. And as a result of that, President Kennedy backed off Sinatra at one point in March of 1962. Sinatra was supposed to host Kennedy at his home in Palm Springs, and the administration decided that instead the president would go to Bing Crosby's house. That sent Sinatra into a rage. And he later eventually, not much later, but later eventually broke off his relationship with Judith Campbell. It's one of the more interesting things about what this book says about J. Edgar Hoover, because a lot of people look at the memos that J. Edgar Hoover would write and look at it and see in it some sort of an evil signal that Hoover was trying to tell Robert Kennedy and President Kennedy, look how much dirt I have on you. If you guys fire me, I'm going to bury you. When in fact, looked at another way, one could say that Hoover did us all a favor, because the mob was fairly close to getting some influence in the White House. And Hoover, very quickly, very privately, without letting anybody else know, put a stop to it.
So, was it Sinatra who introduced Judith Campbell to Sam Giancana?
Yes, mm-hmm. It was. It was, mm-hmm. He introduced Kennedy, I believe, first, and later she was introduced to him.
So did the FBI ever find any hard evidence that Sinatra was involved in any illegal mob-related activities, any activities beyond palling around with members of the mob?
They never got the goods on Sinatra. Sinatra was guilty of association, but guilt by association is not a crime. In fact, it's freedom of association is enshrined in the Constitution.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Sinatra FBI files, and my guests, Tom Koontz and Phil Koontz, are both journalists and their brothers who have edited the Sinatra FBI files and analyzed them in their new book, The Sinatra Files. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guests are journalists Tom Koontz and Phil Koontz, and they have co-edited the Sinatra Files, an edited book of the FBI Sinatra Files, which includes the Coons' analysis of those files. I thought it was interesting that in April of 1963, the special agents in charge of the Los Angeles FBI office asked Hoover to consider bugging Sinatra's home in Palm Springs, and Hoover denied the request.
Exactly. It was another example, kind of surprising example, of Hoover's restraint, if you can imagine that, with Hoover. He, for some reason, at this time, he decided that a microphone surveillance of Sinatra's Palm Springs home was legally unjustified. They didn't have probable cause, I suppose. But imagine if he had approved the bug, what that bug might reveal about Kennedy, Sinatra, and the mob.
Because some of the more interesting things in the book are tape recordings. Hoover was not above, as you can imagine, bugging somebody's house, and he had bugs all over the place in Chicago where Sam Giancana was known to hang out with his associates. And in those recordings, after the mob helped get Kennedy elected, Sam Giancana used his political muscle in Chicago and in West Virginia with the unions to help get out the vote for Kennedy in some pretty crucial ways. That's fairly well documented. After the election, the mob expected Frank Sinatra to get the Kennedys to go easy on them. Instead, President Kennedy appointed his brother, who was an anti-mob crusader from way back, as Attorney General, and the crackdown only intensified. That enraged the mob, and Sam Giancana and his associates can be heard on tape just fuming that Sinatra hadn't made good on his promise to get the FBI to back off. At one point, Johnny Roselli, an underling of Giancana's, quotes Sinatra in a conversation with Giancana, quotes Sinatra as saying, "I took your name, Sam Giancana's name, and I wrote it down on a piece of paper, and I gave it to Bobby Kennedy, and I said, 'Bobby, this, I want you to know this man is my friend. I want you to know that, Bob.'" If that's true, it's a rather extraordinary thing to have a popular singer going to the Attorney General of the United States and asking him to lay off a mobster. Now, it's not quite clear that Sinatra actually did that, because some of the mob in the Giancana and his friends voiced doubt about whether or not Sinatra was doing actually what he said he was doing, because at one point Sinatra, according to Giancana, also promised to talk to Joseph Kennedy, the president's father, and if that didn't work, to go to the president himself. And then Giancana starts acting, gets very, very angry when he says, "Who knows what this guy is doing? I don't know whether to believe him or not." Later, these underworld figures are quoted as actually either fantasizing or thinking out loud. It's not quite clear what they're doing about assassinating Sinatra, maybe his friend Dean Martin. Maybe at one point they talk about poking Sammy Davis Jr.'s other eye out. And one mobster actually fantasizes about throwing a bomb in the face of Bobby Kennedy and says he'd gladly go to jail for the rest of his life if he had a chance to do that. This stuff is kind of... It's troubling in retrospect, and it also, although neither Tommy nor I are conspiracy theorists about the assassination of President Kennedy, it certainly does give one pause when thinking about long-standing allegations that have never been proven that the mob may have been involved.
When was the Sinatra FBI file closed down?
Well, so one's FBI file is probably never closed down once they start one on you, no matter who is in power. But it trailed off after Hoover died, and it's very noteworthy that once in 1972, when Hoover dies, it just very quickly trails off. There's no more of the scurrilous memos that mentioning sex. It just completely dies down, and in the end, what you see is. Since it is, the FBI releases everything, not just the juicy stuff. When they released it, there's a bunch of stuff from the 80s that rather mundane investigations into people making threats against Sinatra's life. And that kind of gives the story of, I think, something of a poetic ending, in that the man who had been pursued by the FBI for so long, in the end, was protected by the FBI.
Frank Sinatra actually got his FBI files through the Freedom of Information Act in 1981. Do you know what impact it had on him to read them and what he did with the information?
I don't know if he was... I think what he said publicly about the files was that it didn't prove anything illegal on his part, mob-wise or otherwise. I don't think he elaborated very much about what was in the files. He got the files released to him so that he could show them to Nevada gaming officials so that he could get his casino license restored. Neither the gaming officials nor Sinatra made the files public at that time. And Sinatra got his gaming license back, which suggested at the time that there was nothing untoward in the files. However, Sinatra also exerted great political influence to get his gaming license back. He had a letter of recommendation from President Reagan to also help him get his license back. So it didn't answer questions about Sinatra. It only raised further ones, I think.
He had gone from being an alleged communist sympathizer to being a Republican, he sang at President Reagan's inaugural.
All right. He also entertained at the Nixon White House. You can see, however, that during Hoover's lifetime and even a little bit after Hoover's lifetime, every politician who cozied up to Frank Sinatra was given a detailed memo from the FBI saying, here's, you know, just thought you'd be interested in the background of this person that you're cozying up to. The Nixon White House got these detailed memos, laying out all of the times that Frank Sinatra is known to have associated with mobsters. And 2 months later, the White House is actively considering whether or not to take advantage of Sinatra's started leaning rightward and whether or not they should take advantage of that. And eventually they did. Spiro Agnew started playing golf with him regularly. He also played golf with President Nixon, and he was invited to state dinners. And the peak of that relationship came when Sinatra came out of retirement. He had announced his retirement in the early 70s, and at the request of Richard Nixon, he came out of retirement to entertain the visiting Italian president at the White House at a state dinner.
It's testimony to his iconic status that presidents, even despite, you know, the downside of his associations with mobsters and what have you, saw a political benefit in currying favor with this man of great talents and a great hold on the popular imagination.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ter.
Tom and Phil Koons edited the new book, The Sinatra Files. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated, Bantam Books Division, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, the story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. From eTapestry.com, creator of web-based fundraising software for managing the donor information of large, medium, and small nonprofits, eTapestry.com. And from Little Brown & Company, publisher of Me Talk Pretty One Day by David Sedaris, available in bookstores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, an American takes on the Chinese film industry. Peter Lohr is China's first independent film producer. We'll talk with him about producing low-budget, urban-themed films, in sharp contrast to the propagandistic work turned out by the state-run studios. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Independent film has been changing the shape of the American film industry. Now it's changing the Chinese film industry with the help of my guest, Peter Lohr. He's an American who started China's first independent film company. 2 years after moving to China in 1996, he produced Spicy Love Soup, which was second at the Chinese box office only to Titanic. In 1999, Variety named him one of 10 producers to watch. His latest film, Shower, will be released in the U.S. July 7th. It was made by the same director as Spicy Love Soup, and it won the International Film Critics Award at the Toronto Film Festival. We invited Peter Lohr to talk with us about working in the Chinese film industry, where he's come up with innovative ways of marketing movies within the communist distribution system and managed to make internationally acclaimed movies in spite of state censorship. Most of his films are contemporary urban stories. I asked him if he's consciously avoiding the kind of historical epics that are most typical of the Chinese films that come here.
Actually, we work with a group of young directors. When we started this company, which is the first independent film company in China, we really wanted to work with young directors because young directors really had no outlet and no way to get a film made. And a young director is going to deal with different issues than a 50 or 60-year-old director is because their life experience is different. We really wanted to deal with issues that are set in big cities in modern China because, as you just mentioned, most Chinese films either deal with the Cultural Revolution or a big sweeping historical epic. And we really thought those two genres had been worked out, and we wanted to try to do something different than the older generation of directors were doing. So we really tried to focus on the last 10 years in big cities in China.
What are the American films that are popular in China?
Titanic is very popular in China, just like everywhere else. Our first film, the film that we did in 98, was the number one Chinese release and second only to Titanic, but there's a big drop-off between number one and number two, unfortunately.
Right. You know, you hear so much about censorship in China and censorship of Chinese movies. It seems kind of crazy for an American to go to China to distribute movies. Have you had any censorship troubles?
We've had a little trouble, but not very much. Our films have had certain cuts, and I think for a producer or a director or any filmmaker, any cut is painful. But in China, basically, that's the law, and you have to work within those parameters. For us, when we started doing this, we thought it was very, very important that the Chinese audience would be able to see the films that we made. So the themes and the topics we've worked on have really tried to focus on topics that we knew we'd find a way to get through the Byzantine censorship process. You know, I think for the directors of the films we've done, and for me, if we're going to talk about China, we're going to talk about social issues, and only foreign film festival audiences and only foreign critics can get to see the film. We're not really sure who we're talking to, because if we're trying to make change and we're trying to bring up topics that people should think about, we hope that the Chinese audience gets to see those films and gets to talk about the topics we're trying to bring up.
Tell us a little bit about what the censorship system for movies is like in China now.
Basically, what happens is you have to first send in a script for approval. Unfortunately, the script almost always gets approved. A lot of things they could tell you at the beginning, they usually don't, and they wait till the end. After your script is approved, you go out and shoot the film, and when this film is finished shooting, you send the final print in for approval again. And basically one of three things can happen. Either it can go through without a scratch, or they can request changes, or the film can be stopped altogether. Those are the three options that you face. It's a nervous time when you send the film in.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the changes that censors have made you make?
In Shower, there was some nudity that was cut. And there were certain scenes that maybe they thought the angle was a little bit too wide. There was about 3 minutes cut, but mostly it was nudity.
Mm-hmm. Other films you've had to make cuts on?
The first film had about 4 minutes. The second film didn't have any cuts at all. So it's you really never know what's going to happen.
What was cut out of the first film?
In China, there's no rating system. There's no PG-13 and R. And in the first film, which was a series of five love stories spanning five different age groups, there was one story that was focused on first love among high school students. And the end of the story was cut because they thought it was a little bit too romantic for young children. Unfortunately, that there's no rating system. We really hope that will develop. We're very, very willing to be the first people to make a film that people under 17 can't see, if that does happen.
Because that's the only way of making a sophisticated film.
Well, not really. I think there's a lot of topics that you can address, and a lot of topics that'll go over the head of a younger audience, but it will still be meaningful for an older audience. It's just that There's certain subjects you want to broach that are not really, you know, really acceptable for a very young audience. So without a rating system, it does add to the limitations.
Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be an independent film producer in China? What's the difference between doing it in China and doing it in the States?
I think independent producers, as far as productions goes, everyone's the same all over the world. You're working on tight budgets and short time and a lot of financial constraints. The big difference in China, which we didn't know when we started doing this, is that, you know, a producer in the States or elsewhere, usually after he's finished with the film, he hands it over to a distributor who then markets and distributes the film. So as soon as the film is done shooting, the producer's work is 80 to 90% done. Whereas in China, there are no good distributors who, especially distributors who are interested in working on films by young directors with young casts, we have to distribute and market the films by ourselves, which is not something we planned to do at the beginning, but it's turned out that way. It's an awful lot of work, and it's not a very fun process. The only interesting thing about the process is that we've traveled all over the country to places we normally wouldn't go and have been able to get very, very close to the audience, which I really think has been a very good educational process for us and for the directors and all the people we work with.
So do you have to make deals with the film houses that show the movies?
In China, it's a very kind of archaic distribution system. In every city, in every province, there is a local distributor who is a government enterprise. And through law, you must work through them. So to distribute a film nationwide in China, you're signing about 40 contracts with 40 different distributors. And that entails 40 different sets of relationships. Some distributors are very strong, some are very weak. Where a distributor is weak, you may be signing a contract with him on the surface and then going directly to the theater to actually arrange how the release will go. A lot of distributors are very, very conservative. They don't spend money in marketing the film, so you have to actually go out and market it yourself. So it's a tremendous amount of work. We're getting better and better at it, but it seems like distribution in China will be something that will take about 10 to 15 years for us really to get a very strong handle on.
My guest is film producer Peter Lohr. His latest Chinese movie, Shower, opens in the U.S. July 7th. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Lohr. He's an independent film producer who is from America but has been working in China for the past few years, where he's had a lot of success. His new film, the new film that he produced, Shower, is opening in the United States. Now, what's it like doing business in a communist country? Can you tell that this isn't a capitalist country, it's officially a communist country?
You know, honestly, not when you're doing film, except for the fact that there are some channels, you know, state-run channels that you must go through. When you're actually dealing with them, it's very, very capitalistic. When you're talking about a contract with a distributor, or you're talking about a distribution plan with a theater, you're talking dollars and cents, just like you would anywhere else. When you're shooting a film in China, it's very much a creative endeavor. So you don't really feel any political or economic overtones of that. To be honest, working in film in China, you don't really get the feeling it's a communist country. You get the feeling it's a country where a lot of people are very, very good businessmen, and you have to be very, very careful, probably just like you would in the States or anywhere else.
Ever have to bribe people to get your film into theaters?
Never have yet. We're lucky. I think that probably does happen, but our films have been quite strong. In 1998, we had the number one film of the year. In 1999, we had the number two film of the year. And now our new film, which is Shower, which you just mentioned, is now the number one film of the year this year. So we're lucky in that the theater owners have made a lot of money from our films, and that makes them much more open and easy to deal with.
Is there a protocol for business meetings in China that's different from what you'd expect in the United States?
I think China is a huge, huge country, and when you're doing business meetings, probably the biggest difficulty that you'll face is that every province you go to is like a different culture. If you're in Beijing, or if you're in Shanghai, or if you're in Chengdu, or if you're in Guangzhou, these cities, they speak different dialects. They have different ways of doing business. They eat different food. You know, everything is very, very different. It's kind of like doing business in Europe, where you're on a plane and, you know, to a country that's only a half-hour flight away, and suddenly everything's very different. So it's very hard to give a kind of a blanket protocol for business in China, though relationships are very, very important. You know, getting to know people, having them trust you and having them like you is a very big key to business. And that takes a lot of time and a lot of patience.
Do you speak the language?
Yes, yes.
How'd you learn it?
I actually, when I put together this project to make this company, I was able to put together the group of investors before we actually started, because I've been working in Asia for a long time. And the deal I got was they sent me off for a year to learn Chinese. So I went to Middlebury College in Vermont for 3 months to a very intensive program. Then I went back to China for 6 months and took classes at three different universities at the same time. And for about 9 months, really did nothing except learn Chinese. The fact that I spoke Japanese fluently first probably helped a lot, especially as far as learning characters. But I was able to nail it down in about 10 to 11 months.
What are you getting out of it doing this in China?
You know, I really love making films. I produced two films in Japan, and I worked for a very big company on pretty big budget films where there was a lot of sponsorship and a lot of pressure involved. And by the time the films got made, they weren't films that I liked very much. And the interesting thing about working in China right now is we have a group of investors who have never read a script. They've never been to the set. They've never got involved in casting. They're very, very silent partners. So it's an interesting situation, because I can go out and make the films I want to make, which is very hard to do anywhere in the world. We were doing an interview in Europe one time, and somebody asked me, "What do you like about making films in China?" I said, "You know, the freedom of it," which they were, you know, was very shocking yeah. to them. But the economic freedom, we are actually making the films we want to make. I can go out and work with a director, and we can pick a subject we want to make, and we can go make that, and we don't have to have a lot of creative interference from investors, which is really, really nice.
Yeah, well, that is a paradox.
Yeah.
How did you find the filmmakers that you were interested in working with when you got to China?
That was really the main reason I went to China in the first place, is I had met a lot of young people I thought were really, really talented that I really, really wanted to work with. When we first started out, probably one of the problems is that a lot of them had been approached by a lot of people before, both domestic, you know, I had Chinese people and foreign people. And people had come up to them and said, you know, "I have money, you know, let's make a movie together," and it never happened. So when I first got to China, probably the biggest problem was a lack of trust. You know, when you kind of said to people, "Hey, you know, we're going to make a company, we're going to make films, let's work together," no one really believed you. They're like, "Oh, yeah, great," you know. But as we've gone forward and as we've made films, we've had, you know, it's become an opposite scenario. We get about 70 to 80 scripts a week from around the country. We're meeting a lot of great people. So we have about five or six more directors that we want to work with, and we're waiting for the right script or the right idea to come along to do that. I think the talent level in China, whether you're talking about directors or cinematographers or actors, is just absolutely fantastic.
My guest is Peter Lohr. He's an American film producer who has been living in China these past few years, working as an independent film producer and having a lot of success. And the latest film he produced, Shower, is opening in the United States. In America, a lot of the success of movies has to do with the enormous amount of advertising and promotion behind the major motion picture films. How do you promote and advertise your films in China?
We do, but it's certainly nothing like the United States. We can't afford to do TV commercials, and there's no Super Bowl commercial for a summer release.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, in China, you face a big problem. The market is very, very flat, and the audience really doesn't like to watch Chinese films anymore. And there's a tremendous amount of pirate product that the audience can watch on VCD anytime they want. So if you're going to attract people to the movie theater, you've got to have something very, very special. But at the same time, because the market isn't that big, you don't have a lot of money to spend on promotion. So it becomes very, very important to attract a core audience. Word of mouth is essential. In China, there's really no negative film criticism. So a movie is never panned. So when a paper or a TV program says a movie is great, the audience doesn't really believe that, because they never say a movie is bad.
Why is it that way?
I think it's a cultural thing that, you know, if a movie went out and got panned by a critic, you know, the investor or the film studio behind that movie would call the head of the paper and say, you know, "How could you do this to me?" The head of the paper would turn around and say to the critic, I think you should lighten up. It's just kind of, there hasn't been a tradition of criticism for film in China. Because the opening up a film where anyone can make a film about any subject is really quite a recent thing. You know, in the last 20 or 30 years, film was very much a propaganda tool used for making, you know, messages that the state wanted to come out. So suddenly you have films that aren't that way, and people aren't used to having the right to criticize a film. So what you've got to do with a film is you've got to attract a core public following, and basically you have to wait for word of mouth. Word of mouth is essential. Because if someone's friend tells them the film is good, they will believe that. If you can get that first group of audience to go in and to get the word out, the film can take off. And we've been able to do that. I think the fact that our films are young and the fact that we've kind of got our own feeling right now, and people will come to see a film just based on the fact that the film was done by this company, really helps a lot. Our marketing is kind of very much word of mouth, a lot of press-oriented stuff, not very much paid advertising. You know, when we can, we try to find a sponsor to help with the budget for marketing. So whereby in the States you may spend half of your total, half of a film's budget on marketing, we probably spend more like a fifth of the total budget on marketing.
Now, I read something in the Wall Street Journal about a tissue box campaign in taxis in China.
Yeah, what we did actually on this movie, and to be very honest, it was a big failure. But for 2 years, we worked on the Beijing Taxi Authority because there are a lot of bus ads in China, and they're very expensive, and we couldn't afford them. So what we thought we would do is we'd make tissue boxes to put in cabs that would have, you know, the logo of the film on them, because no one had ever done that. So it took us 2 years of talking to the taxi authority because they had all kinds of issues, you know, like, well, what if people throw the tissues out the window and there's a lot of litter? You know, what happens when the boxes get empty and there's no tissues left? And we basically worked with them for a long time, and they finally approved it. And we got the right to put tissue boxes in 20,000 taxi cabs in Beijing. You know, we had to pay for all the production of that. And we finally did it. The only problem is about 70% of them, the taxi drivers liked the way the boxes looked, so they took them home and didn't put them in the cab. So that's an example of a great idea that didn't really work that well. Though some people saw it, and it was kind of a cool thing because no one had ever done it before.
What did you think the tissue boxes with the film's logo on it in taxi cabs would be a big selling point for the movie?
Well, it's not a selling point for a movie, but it's advertising that we can't normally afford to do. You know, we can't afford to do TV commercials, and we can't afford to do radio commercials, and we can't afford billboards. So we've always got to try to think of a way. And when something's never been done before, there's probably not a price structure built around it. You know, taxi cabs in Beijing you really can't imagine how many taxis are in Beijing. I mean, we put the boxes into 20,000 cabs. That's only half the cabs in the city of Beijing. So we thought that if we had the boxes sitting there, it might be something that drew attention to the film. You know, we try to do things differently, things that no one's ever done before. And we hope that that'll create interest. You know, the tissues and the film have nothing in common. But it was a way to do a cheap advertisement and a way to try to do something different.
It's great. It's like you're bringing promotional capitalist know-how to to China.
Well, we try. There's a lot of things you can't do, and the nature of the market, you know, there's a lot of things you can't afford, but we're always trying to figure out something to do that no one's done before. You know, the first film, we released the first pop music soundtrack in China, you know, which sounds like a kind of a very easy thing to do, but at the time, no one had ever done it before, and actually a lot of the record distributors, you know, the didn't really want to do it. They didn't think soundtrack was something that was going to work.
How'd you sell them on the idea?
Basically, we went around to a lot of record stores on our own. We put up the posters on our own, and we really promoted the soundtrack on our own because we knew that the state-run publishing house wasn't going to get excited enough to really do something about it.
My guest is Peter Lohr, the American who founded the first independent film company in China, where he's lived since 1996. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Peter Lohr is my guest. He's an independent film producer who is American but has been working in China these past few years. And the latest film he produced, Shower, is opening in the United States. What are movie theaters like in China? I guess there's probably a big range of styles.
Well, they run the whole gamut. You know, actually, in Shanghai and Beijing, there's big modern international standard multiplexes. In some smaller cities, the theaters are you know, horrific. You know, a lot of people in smaller areas would much rather watch a video compact disc at home on their, you know, on their TV and stereo system, because the quality is going to be better than a theater. It really runs the whole gamut, just as ticket prices run the whole gamut. In a better theater, tickets are more expensive. In a worse theater, tickets are cheaper. One very interesting thing on Spicy Love Soup, which was incredibly successful, what you can ultimately do is you can do 16-millimeter distribution in the countryside. You sell the film to these 16-millimeter companies who actually drive around the rural areas in a big white truck with a projector, and they stop in these small towns and they rope off a field. They put up the projector and they actually show the film on the side of a white truck, which is amazing. I actually went to one of these screenings. There was at least 6,000 people watching one screening of the film, probably paying about a penny each. But the film, you know, a successful film can be seen by a tremendous, tremendous amount of people in China.
Well, what is youth culture like in China now? Is there an MTV there? Can you tell us something about, like, the popular music now?
Well, actually, we also run a record company in China. We run China's biggest alternative music label. And we've signed, you know, some punk bands in China. We also have a lot of alternative music coming in from Taiwan. The youth culture in China is very, very vibrant. And I think that goes for film and it goes for music and it goes for the internet as well. A lot of things are happening. You know, young people want new things. They want different things. And that market exists. That's really the people we try to speak to with our films and with our music and with everything we do. Last year, we sold 7 million records in China, you know, alternative records from, you know, alternative non-pop groups. There's a big youth culture in China, especially in the major cities.
Has rap caught on in China, and has a lot of, like, hip-hop lingo caught on? Fashions?
Well, hip-hop lingo hasn't caught on because people speak, you know, in Chinese. Mm-hmm. But there's a tremendous amount of slang that's used in China. And you do find new music and you do find film and you do find a lot of things changing slang, and slang is ever evolving. You know, hip-hop music, actually trance is very, very big in China. House music is very, very big in China. I think you'd really be amazed if you went to Beijing and you went to the clubs, because they're very, very much like a club would be in London or New York, believe it or not. There is a very, very serious nightlife in Beijing, like right now, which there wasn't 2 years ago. I've been in Beijing for 5 years, and it used to be really boring. And suddenly, it's just really, really picked up. I've had friends that come over to Beijing, and they're like, "I can't believe this. This is amazing. Where I live is very boring compared to this." So, you know, China is a very different place. But like any place, there is going to be, you know, an ever-evolving, very powerful youth movement going on all the time, and that's certainly the case right now in China.
Is that kind of nightlife, or, you know, techno music or post-punk music ever denounced by the government?
I don't think there's ever really a direct denouncement. It's just not something that's very accepted. You know, you can get the record out. It takes a lot of work, just like it does for us to get the movie out. You spend time and you understand, and you go through a censorship process, but you can get through that censorship process. It just takes a lot of patience and a lot of work. You know, there are Chinese songs with expletives that get through censorship. You just have to be willing to do that. Now, there are some limits. I mean, the big state central-run TV station is not going to play a music video by, you know, a thrash band or a punk band. A lot of radio stations won't play the record, but with the internet evolving and a lot of other stuff going on, there are ways to get it out. There are fanzines in China. And as long as the record can get through censorship, you're going to find people to listen to it.
Do you ever feel that the government is suspicious of you as an American doing business in China?
I think we were very smart about that. And at the very beginning, though obviously the government knew what was going on because we had a legally established company, I tried to be very low profile. On the credits, I used my Chinese name. I didn't do interviews. I never went on TV. I never went on the radio. I just kind of stayed back. And the first film was very, very successful. And it also won almost all the major awards in China that year. And by the second film, I think we were much more accepted, because we were making films that obviously the Chinese audience could relate to. And we were doing things within the law, and we were doing things the way that it had to be done. So I think that built up a certain amount of trust. And as the films have been more and more successful, we've been able to create a relationship with the government where I don't think there's a lot of suspicion. we have a mutually decent relationship. You know, obviously there is going to be debate and conflict sometimes about issues, but I think we get along pretty well with them, and I think they know what we want to do and where we're going with that. So there probably isn't as much suspicion as there was at the beginning. I mean, at the beginning, we have the first independent company, film company ever established, and there's a foreign guy running it, and that's something that's going to make people nervous. But I don't think that's really happening anymore.
You've told us a lot about how you've been getting your films produced and distributed in China. Your new film, Shower, is coming to theaters in the States. How have you gotten it distributed in the States?
Shower to us it's just been amazing. Actually, last year in September, Shower went to the Toronto Film Festival. And I was a young producer with a young director with a Chinese film that no one really had heard of. And there's 360 films in Toronto. And in the first day, the first time the film was shown to an audience, the audience just went crazy over it. And the next day, the press and industry screening was full. You know, we went from being very ignored to suddenly being very hot. And we were able to sell the film to 17 countries in that one afternoon, basically based on that first audience reaction to the film. The film ended up winning the International Critics Award at Toronto. We've won actually 6 awards at 6 different festivals. And there's really been kind of a grassroots groundswell around the film. The film was ultimately sold to 56 countries. And, you know, I think which is a record for a Chinese film, which is something we really never expected. And Sony picked the film up for the States, which is the first of our films that's ever going to be released in the States, and obviously the first ever by a big distributor like Sony. So it's been a fantastic ride and not something we expected. And you know, being here today is an incredible treat because usually we're doing this in China. Suddenly I'm back in New York, and this is where I'm from, and I'm doing an interview in New York, which is really, really nice. So I think the film is ultimately going to be out in 50 cities around the country, which to us is just amazing.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us about your work.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's been great.
Peter Lohr is an American who founded China's first independent film company. His latest film, Shower, will be released in the U.S. July 7th. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated, Bantam Books Division. Publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers. The story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. From Martindale Hubbell, creator of lawyers.com. A legal resource for finding a lawyer and information about the law. AOL keyword, lawyers.com. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? Damn right.
On the next Fresh Air, Samuel L. Jackson, the star of Shaft, talks about his movies and his life. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Who is the man that would risk his neck for his brother, man?